I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for Monday, September 9th. President Trump abruptly calls off talks with Taliban and Afghan officials, further delaying the peace process for Afghanistan.
A peace has to come. People want a peace to come, but it's a question of what kind of a peace.
We'll look at what's next for negotiations with the Taliban nearly 18 years since September 11th. And it's been 25 years since the premiere of Friends. We're hearing from you on what still works about the show and what hasn't held up.
All the Friends characters look perfect. They're all hilariously flawed.
My problems with the show were the lack of diversity and, biggest of all, that Ross character.
I hated Friends. I hated it then and I still do.
Let's get started. This Wednesday will mark 18 years since the September 11th terrorist attacks. Members of the extremist group Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 people on U.S. soil that day. Weeks after 9/11, the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan began under President George W. Bush.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
And in the nearly two decades since, tens of thousands of Afghan civilians and soldiers have been killed in the war. At least 2,300 U.S. soldiers have also died. For the past 10 months, the Trump administration has participated in 9 rounds of negotiations with officials from the Taliban in the hopes of putting an official end to the U.S.-Afghanistan war. But now, those talks have stalled. Over the weekend, the president abruptly called off a meeting at Camp David with Taliban officials and Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, citing a recent attack in Kabul that killed 12 people, including one U.S. soldier. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo explaining that decision to ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
I hope it's the case that the Taliban will change their behavior, will recommit to the things that we've been talking to them about for months. In the end, this will be resolved through a series of conversations. I hope the Taliban will agree to meet with the Afghan government. President Ghani
asked
for that.
They say the jihad's going to continue. They just put out a statement.
Yeah, we'll see. Let me assure you, America's capacity to protect our nation from a terror attack ever emanating from that place again, that effort will continue.
We're going to examine what's next for U.S.-Taliban negotiations against the backdrop of 18 years of war. Joining me now to discuss is Ali Latifi, a freelance journalist based in Kabul. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Ali.
Thank you.
Also with us is Abdul Qader Sino, a professor of political science at Indiana University. Thank you for being with us, Abdul Qader.
My pleasure.
Ali, let's start with you. We saw what the president tweeted out. And what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said on television over the weekend. Beyond that, what do we know about why the Camp David meeting was canceled?
It's kind of hard to tell exactly why the meeting was canceled. It's obviously a Washington-based decision, so it's something that I think people in Washington would have a better sense of. Obviously, if you look at what the president said, he said something about, you know, quote-unquote, as he said, great, great soldier being killed, U.S. soldier. But the truth is that in the last couple weeks, several U.S. soldiers have been killed. And in the 9 rounds of talks, U.S. soldiers have been targeted and killed as well. And more importantly, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of Afghan civilians have been killed in these attacks. And the president really didn't say anything up until now. So the only sort of theory at this point, without knowing the details of what's going on in Washington, is that he had to buckle under pressure because it seemed like both his Republican base and even the Democrats, depending on how much he listens to them, were very much against this vague deal.
Abdul Qader, one of the things that's come under intense scrutiny here is the fact that September 11th is just days away, and the fact that the president wanted to hold these talks at Camp David on that same week is sort of drawing a lot of attention. What's your take on that? Did it make sense for the president to want to do that?
Well, it may be indicative of poor judgment. It also may be meant to show that this is an end of an era where a problem has been dealt with, but that is certainly not true because the Taliban, in fact, did not attack the United States on 9/11. It's Al-Qaeda that did. It's hard to tell, to be honest. I mean, this whole process of negotiation has been quite convoluted. The administration is divided among those who support negotiations and those who don't. The president himself waffles also, if you look at President Trump's negotiation tactics, the way he conducts himself in all sorts of negotiations, often it includes breaking the negotiations and threatening never to start them again, and then he would resume later. So it may be all part of a longer series of interactions in his mind that may lead to another invitation, an agreement later, well after 9/11, when the symbolism will not be as relevant.
Now, Abdul Qadir, we've heard that the lead U.S. negotiator for Afghanistan said last week that an agreement already had been made with the Taliban, at least in principle. Do we know anything about the terms of that deal?
Oh, yes. There are two areas. Basically, the Taliban have agreed not to host Al-Qaeda or other anti-U.S. organizations on their territories in Afghanistan. And the United States basically agreed to withdraw from Afghanistan. This much has been agreed upon. Now, what remains are other issues, such as the Taliban forming a government together with the current government in a coalition or a common regime, whether the Taliban would allow or support the elections, whether the current government would release Taliban prisoners, and whether there will be a ceasefire. Now, those issues, in general, there is something of a meeting of the minds between the administration and the Taliban. However, the government in Kabul does not agree to what the United States wants to commit to in its own name on those issues.
What impact do you think this is going to have on U.S.-Taliban negotiations from here, Abdul Qadir?
They will resume. I have no doubt in my mind that those negotiations will resume for the simple fact that the Trump administration and any other administration that will come later have no reason not to resume them. Otherwise, the alternative is just to muddle through in Afghanistan, and the United States has been doing that for the last 18 years to no effect whatsoever. And so for things to change, they have to talk to the Taliban and they have to reach an agreement. And as far as the Taliban are concerned, they're getting everything they want at almost no concession.
Ali, the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, has been sidelined largely during these U.S.-Taliban negotiations, and yet he was supposed to be at the Camp David meeting, which was, of course, canceled abruptly. What has been his role in these negotiations, if any?
He has no role. That's one of the major problems, is that the president and his administration and the Afghan people in general have no role whatsoever in these discussions. For instance, one of the concession points is this claim that the Taliban won't host Al-Qaeda or any other foreign group again. They haven't done that in 18 years, and they can't do that in the future. So they're really not giving up anything in this, right? They're getting the U.S. to withdraw, and they'll get whatever political terms they want, but they gave up nothing in this. And in the meantime, the actual administration of Afghanistan has not been involved in this at all, nor is any women, nor any youth, nor any different like ethnic minorities or any ethnic groups, literally any other Afghan other than the Taliban involved in these discussions. And that's a major, major issue for people.
Abdul Qadir, when we look at, we talked a little bit about Trump's approach, President Trump's approach in negotiating, generally speaking, but when we look at his administration's strategy with dealing with the Taliban, how does it compare, in your opinion, to George W. Bush and Barack Obama's approaches?
It is very different. Basically, George W. Bush wanted to invade Afghanistan, defeat the Taliban, and then did not invest much in Afghanistan, which led to the current quagmire. He had a window for a few years to rebuild a good government in Afghanistan, to help Afghans rebuild a good government in Afghanistan. He failed to do it because he didn't care to invest the resources. It was a cynical occupation. For President Obama, he was handed an Afghanistan that was corrupt, that was a government that was ineffective, and he decided to have a surge, pour resources, give it all the United States had to make it work. $1 trillion was spent on Afghanistan in terms of military expenditures and in building institutions, etc. And his administration failed. And so basically, when Trump came, as part of his campaign commitment, was to withdraw from Afghanistan, disengage from Afghanistan, which seemed to be a losing war. So he had to find a way to do so. But before disengaging, he wanted to have a card he could play, so he increased the number of troops by about 5,000 to 14,000, you know, so he could have more leverage in the negotiations. And those would be the first ones to leave Afghanistan later in that multi-step withdrawal.
Earlier this year, Abdul Qadir, you wrote that if a U.S.-Taliban agreement is reached, it would mark a major turning point in U.S. foreign policy in the Muslim world. Explain what that means, please.
Well, look at it this way. In theory, the United States is in Afghanistan to help the regime it established after invading the country in late 2001, establish itself, create democracy, etc. Quite a few Afghans put their lot, their future, their fortune with the United States. They bet on that alliance and on the words of three different U.S. administrations. Now, if the United States leaves and the Taliban, you really like it to have a civil war in Afghanistan, and the Taliban sooner or later will probably occupy big chunks of Afghanistan, quite possibly including the capital Kabul, if not the whole country, as they almost did in 2001. And those people will be, the allies of the United States would be paying a major, major price for their alliance with the United States. Now, imagine you are a leader in Somalia, in Syria, or in Iraq, allied with the United States. Then you will have to reconsider, otherwise you'll be foolish, working with the United States. Because if they abandon their Afghan allies, they could abandon the Kurds. They could abandon the government of in Mogadishu, in Somalia, etc. And so there will be less readiness to ally with the United States, less trust in the United States, and therefore every U.S. venture, every U.S. involvement in the Middle East, North Africa, and beyond, you know, will be much more difficult.
Ali, I want to bring you in on that point because I'm curious to know what civilians in Afghanistan, whether or not they feel, if there is not a deal reached, that what Abdul Qadir is predicting could in fact happen, that there could be even more instability.
Fear. That's the exact fear. But the truth is that, you know, every Afghan knows that a deal has to be reached, that a peace has to come. Really, the only people that think that, you know, a military victory is still possible is the government and its allies. And so, you know, there's massive insecurity and corruption and different issues, not to mention this idea of the Taliban and Daesh. So the truth is that, you know, a peace has to come. People want a peace to come. But it's a question of what kind of a peace. Is it like a legitimate peace that actually includes, because that's the other thing. If let's say they include the Afghan government. If it only includes the Afghan government, the Taliban, and the United States, it's still not properly representative of 32 million people in the country.
Abdul Qadir, we mentioned at the top of the segment, we're nearing 18 years since the September 11th terrorist attacks that were carried out by Al-Qaeda and the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. What have been the personal and financial costs of the war for both the United States and Afghanistan?
Well, let's start with Afghanistan. Tens of thousands of Afghan civilians have died. And in fact, it's really hard to count the casualties. So I wouldn't be surprised if the number was closer to 100,000 or more. And so the suffering has been tremendous in Afghanistan. And the casualties were from both sides. And, you know, the United States is not blameless in this at all. On the other hand, some groups in Afghanistan, members of some groups, have benefited from the Western presence, have made advancements, especially the Hazara minority, members of the Hazara minority and other minorities, while in the South, they have incurred the most damage. As for the United States, the cost has been $1 trillion in treasury in a time when the United States debt is ballooning out of control at $22 trillion, perhaps out of control, but it's becoming really large, and about 5,000 U.S. soldiers and contractors have been killed fighting in Afghanistan. Those are not trivial numbers. However, they're not destructive for the United States. But Afghanistan is at a point where it will probably have to start from scratch again. Its economy is not doing great at all. Its government will probably collapse at some point in the future, will have to be rebuilt on completely different bases. And so it will be starting from scratch again.
Abdul Qadir Sinan is a professor of political science at Indiana University, and Ali Latifi is a freelance journalist based in Kabul. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Last week, YouTube agreed to pay $170 million in fines as part of a settlement with the Federal Trade Commission.
The FTC took aim at YouTube because it said that it violated something called the COPPA law.
That's Recode senior correspondent Peter Kafka. And COPPA stands for Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. And that went into effect back in 1998 at the tail of the first internet boom. and it imposed certain requirements on websites targeting children under the age of 13.
In the shortest version of saying it is they're saying YouTube was taking personal information about the kids and then using it to serve those kids' ads, which they're not supposed to do, hence the fine.
But paying a fine wasn't the only concession YouTube had to make.
What the settlement requires YouTube to do is ask people who are uploading YouTube videos, which is a gazillion people, they upload hundreds of hours per minute, to say, hey, is this stuff aimed at kids? Yes or no? And if you say, yes, this is aimed at kids, then YouTube will treat that video differently. They won't do a lot of tracking around it. It's unlikely they're going to serve ads. They certainly won't serve behaviorally targeted ads towards kids and essentially will sort of segment those away from sort of traditional YouTube viewing.
How popular, and this is going to age me here, but how popular is YouTube among the youth today, Peter?
If you know a youth, if you know someone who has a youth, you'll know it's extraordinarily popular. YouTube certainly knows that. They legally couldn't say that, but they certainly knew it. And in the FTC complaint, they say, look, not only did you know it, but you were telling advertisers, this is how you can reach kids.
So we've seen a couple of these settlements coming out of the FTC against big tech companies. And often the criticism is, well, is that actually going to have any impact on, in this case, YouTube's behavior, or is this just a slap on the wrist?
There are two main sort of avenues of complaint about this settlement. This is, by the way, echoes an FTC $5 billion settlement with Facebook earlier this summer. One is the fines should simply be much, much bigger. One of the FTC commissioners who voted against it, who also voted against Facebook, said it should be something in the billions. And then there's an argument that says YouTube should be required to do much more. Whatever amount of money they're going to spend, they're probably going to generate $20 billion in revenue in 2019. It's almost impossible to levy a fine that will be meaningful to one of these companies at this size. But what you could do is change their behavior fundamentally. So another commissioner who dissented said, we want YouTube to put the onus on itself to track this stuff to see, is this video actually a kid's video? If so, let's treat it differently.
So let's talk about that, because the onus right now is on the content creator, the person that's making the content, right? To tell YouTube, after this settlement at least, to tell YouTube, this is for kids.
In terms of the settlement. Mm-hmm. Now, YouTube says, look, we're going to go above and beyond the settlement, and of our own accord, we're also going to police this. But there's no requirement that they do it, and there's no sort of parameters pasted around that, and they could decide in a year they don't want to do it.
Kids' content creation is a big market. I mean, you know, we grew up prior to YouTube and, you know, cartoons on Saturday morning. But now, I mean, the amount of content that's available to kids is staggering.
It's all of the internet, right? So it's Saturday morning cartoons for them. It's after school cartoons for them. It's anything. It's Bustle where they're going to do their homework. It's just part of their life. It's built in.
Is this going to have an impact on the content creators, on the people that are making this stuff for kids?
This is what YouTube says itself. It said this is going to cause problems for people who've made money doing this. We're going to try to help them out as well. We're going to spend $100 million over 3 years to help these creators figure out ways to reach kids and to show them stuff that will generate ads, even though the ads won't generate as much money.
Why is this a problem? And what I mean by that is, you know, we just mentioned Saturday morning cartoons that have been, you know, around in, say, the 70s and 80s. And in between all of those cartoons were ads aimed specifically at kids. Why is it that this particular type of advertising was under the microscope here? Why can't we advertise to kids online?
You can advertise to kids. You just have to do it with sort of blinders on. You have to say, here's a children's show about dogs. Would you like to advertise on it? Not knowing anything else about who's going to watch it. And that's the kind of advertising YouTube is going to offer now, which sells for much less.
We mentioned that this settlement was essentially based on violation of COPPA, which is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, and basically says you can't collect data from kids under 13. That law is from 1998, for those who are counting. I don't want to do the counting, but that is quite a while ago, and internet use has changed a lot since then. Is it really the data collection on kids we're worried about here?
I think this is an overall complaint about the internet and the overall complaint about these giant internet companies that have basically run without regulation. And so in context, this is part of a larger push to sort of push and pull these internet platforms in various directions. But we really don't know how we want to regulate them. There is not anything approaching consensus about what to do about Google, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera. These are international companies. They serve the entire world. It's very unclear that politicians in Washington have the capacity to really sit down and figure this stuff out.
And that's something that I wonder how that's changed under this current administration. I mean, the big privacy push was under the Obama administration, and that was also sort of, you know, floundering a little bit there. But is this administration any friendlier to privacy guidelines, at least?
Well, if you're talking about privacy, who knows? This administration and Republicans currently today are spending a lot of time criticizing the internet platforms for supposedly censoring conservative viewpoints. Not a lot of evidence for that, but that is their major complaint. So this is the analogy I use is school reform. If you go ask someone, hey, should the schools be reformed? Everyone says yes. You say, what's the problem? And then it depends who you're talking to. Some people want creationism taught in the schools. Some people want metal detectors. Some people want more funding for gifted and talented, on and on and on. And so no one actually agrees what the problem is.
You are a parent yourself. Uh-huh. There are many parents out there. I wonder how much parents know about what their kids are viewing on YouTube. Are you concerned about what your kids are seeing on YouTube?
Yeah, I am. I know enough to be concerned. I know enough not to be overly concerned because I'm hoping that I'm educating my kids and giving them the capacity to sort of interpret what they're seeing, and I'm asking them about stuff they're seeing. But I'm certainly not monitoring everything they're watching. I used to be able to send them in the basement and they would watch Netflix, and I knew they were pretty much in a container and they weren't going to get a weird surprise. I know that's not the case with YouTube, and it's on me to be talking to them, limiting access to computers when I can with the knowledge that I can only do so much, that they're going to go to school, they're going to go to a friend's house, and I can't keep this stuff away from them forever.
What should parents be doing, especially, I mean, you're someone that's immersed in the technology space, you write about it, you know about it. A lot of parents probably don't know as much about it as you do. So what do you recommend parents do if they want to have more control over what their kids are seeing?
I'd start by looking at what your kids are seeing. You know, I do it all the time. It's very tempting to hand a kid a tablet and say, I got to eat dinner. I got to do whatever. Go do this thing and I'll go do my thing. And I'm going to continue to do that. But periodically, watch with them. See what they're watching. You might ask them questions about it, even if you can't sit with them at the time. I don't know why I'm giving parenting advice, but here I am.
It's my fault.
Ask them what they were watching. I often hear my kids saying weird stuff. And I'll say, where did that come from? And they'll say, YouTube. Or they won't say YouTube. They'll explain something else, and I'll eventually divine that it was YouTube. So just get a sense of what they're consuming. And by the way, this doesn't have anything to do with YouTube. This is across the internet. And do a little bit of research, too. I mean, if you think Instagram is a sharing, photo sharing tool, you're only partially correct. If you've got a 13-year-old, it's also a messaging platform for them, which, again, might be entirely fine for you, but you should know that your kids are talking to other kids on Instagram. They're not just posting photos there.
And finally, we mentioned the law here that started in 1998, Children's Online Privacy Protection. Are we left with this 20-year-old some odd law? Is there any likelihood that we'll get an update here, given the fact that the internet itself has updated quite significantly since then?
We certainly could, and that law was amended fairly early on. Right now, most of the focus when people are talking about reforming the internet is about a 1996 telecom law, the Communications Decency Act, something specifically called Section 230. Keep hearing about that. So there is an appetite for going back to old laws and at least discussing whether or not to change them, whether we're actually going to do that, whether we're actually going to pass legislation. I'm not a political expert. It seems hard to believe that it's going to happen anytime soon.
Peter Kafka is the senior correspondent at Recode. Peter, thanks so much for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you.
It's been 25 years since the world met Rachel, Ross, Chandler, Joey, Monica, and Phoebe. The TV show Friends ran for 10 seasons, pulling in somewhere between 25 and 30 million viewers every week, and its popularity hasn't slowed down since. Thanks to streaming platforms like Netflix, there's now a whole new generation of Friends fans, and we asked you to weigh in on the show 25 years later.
Hi, this is Nicole from Tampa, Florida. I love Friends. I still watch it, and I'm 47 years old. I've also gotten my 18-year-old daughter to watch it, and she loves it too. Plus, she says all of her friends are addicted to it as well. I love it even though all the Friends characters look perfect, they're all hilariously flawed.
Hi, I'm Theo Louis from New York City. I was never, ever drawn to the TV sitcom Friends. As a gay Latino from the Bronx, it didn't speak to me. Now, ironically, I live one block in the West Village from the building that was used simply as the facade for the show, as thousands of annoying tourists appeared daily from throughout the globe, posing for photographs outside the edifice.
As one of our listeners told us there, while Friends has continued to gain new fans decades later, it's also come under renewed scrutiny for depicting a very privileged and very white version of New York City. Joining me now to discuss the legacy of Friends is Saatchi Kohl, senior culture writer at BuzzFeed, and Willa Paskin, Slate's television critic and host of the Decoder Ring podcast. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Willa, let's start with you. We're living in an age where we have tons of television shows at our disposal. A lot of folks who weren't even born when the show was on are binging on Friends right now on Netflix. Why does it have so much mass appeal among younger generations? I mean, and I will add, I thought no one cared about Gen X, so why do they care now?
I mean, the thing is that's interesting about Friends is that for all the TV that there is, what there sort of isn't are sitcoms in the classic sense, like a show where you don't have to follow a huge long story arc. Every episode is very cozy and very similar. And all of those shows, there's a bunch of them, but The Office and Friends are sort of two of the prime examples, have been hugely successful in streaming services because no one's actually watching network television and the places that are still making that kind of sitcom. The thing about Friends is, right, like every episode you turn it on, the six of them are there doing something, you know, funny and cute and whatever, and it's very it's very comforting, and it's that comfort has obviously translated even to younger people, who I think there's also sort of additional comforts, which is that, you know, it's like a world in which there's no internet. You know, you drop by and you see your pals, like there's a sort of nostalgia to it, so it's not like super old, it's not like in black and white or something, but it isn't exactly right now.
Saatchi, looking back, there were lots of questionable and cringeworthy moments on Friends. For you, you don't think the show's aged well. Why not?
No, I mean, it's a show about New York where everybody appears to be white. It's a show that makes fun of gay people and fat people as if they have no other characteristics. It's a show that makes fun of somebody's possibly drag queen mother, but is clearly a transgender woman. Like, that's not really clear. I mean, nothing about the show has really aged that well for a current audience. But I think the thing that has aged worse is that it is not funny. It is deeply, chaotically unfunny.
We want to get into some of the criticism, especially about the homophobia, in a minute. Willa, you're laughing there. You think it's funny?
No, I mean, it's just the six of those cast members are like, that's like a killer cast. They're very good at their job. The thing that made me laugh is, like, people have been fighting about whether or not Friends was funny. Like, when Friends was on the air, all the Seinfeld stands were like, this is garbage, remedial, basic sitcomery. How dare anyone, like, say this is very good? And it's like, some people, you know, funny is personal. I think there's millions and millions of people who find Friends to be very funny. I would also just say that while it's absolutely true that it's obscenely white and they're very privileged and nothing about that is particular to Friends and, like, all its cohort of shows were equally retrograde. And I think the sum of the stuff, certainly about the fat suit things, like Monica's history as an obese woman, and sort of the gay jokes about Chandler and Joey's relationship, and sort of about Ross's ex-wife being a lesbian, those things actually I think are much more complicated. Like, Joey and Chandler's relationship is this deep and huge loving relationship, and though, like, their breakup is, like, when they, you know, their breakup is treated as sort of in one episode as kind of a romance. And, like, that's a joke, but it's also not a joke. And I think that the portrayal of Ross's ex-wife was actually pretty, like, straightforward and matter-of-fact and respectful. Like, it's not really a punchline, it's just, like, a thing about their lives.
Which as somebody watching it in the 90s, I'm outing myself here again, I thought that was a pretty, you know, to be co-parenting with your lesbian ex-wife who's in a lesbian relationship at the time in the 90s, that was considered pretty progressive.
Yeah, and they're definitely not bad parents.
No, they're not. But what I want to bring up, Saatchi, to your point here, is that can't we say, like, is this a little finger wagging in the rearview mirror? Like, can't we say, you know, that a lot of these shows, I mean, it was the 90s, right? It's not 2019. In 20 years, are we probably going to do the same thing about a lot of shows that are on now, right? Like, all these shows are problematic and they just didn't rate.
Yeah.
So, like, how do we, you know, how do we really gauge these? Because I know in some of the pieces, in your piece, you kind of compared these to, like, Seinfeld, which was hugely problematic, particularly for Puerto Rican communities in particular. But it was also hilarious, right?
Yeah.
Like, can we hold those two things in?
I think you can. To be clear, I think people are more than entitled to watch something that is bad. There's no skin off my back. You can watch a bad show all you want. I'm not going to lose any sleep. Enjoy being wrong. But I think you can hold two things in your hands at once, that maybe you watch it and you enjoy it, but you know that it's, like, not great. Like, yeah, it's aged poorly. But also, I don't understand this excuse of, like, Liz, come on, it was the 90s. Like, I don't know, man. Like, I'm pretty sure it was always bad to make fun of fat people. Whether or not a network was going to be held responsible for that is a separate question. Right. But yeah, you can feel two things at once. I don't begrudge anybody for wanting to watch something comforting and soothing. But for me, when I watch it, it's uncomfortable and unbearable. And I do think that the greatest problem with the show is that it isn't funny.
Mm. Well, I do want to bring up one thing. The show did have a big influence on haircuts. The Rachel, I had what I called a modified Rachel back in the day. Willa, has that success in terms of the look been replicated since in other shows? And I want to pose the same thing to you, Sachi, because I feel like I'm starting to see this revival of 90s fashion, and I'm wondering if Friends has anything to do with that.
I mean, some of that is like, it's a little chicken and the egg with like the total disintegration of the TV audience. So like Big Bang Theory is a big audience thing, but it was sort of one of the very last really successful sitcoms with like 20 million audience,
Theory is also one that like we're forced to watch, I feel like, because it's on every channel all at the same
and
time.
And in 20 years, our children's children will be asking us, what was wrong with you? That is the thing to keep in mind about that show.
About the Big Bang Theory? No one is going to be watching the Big Bang Theory like they're watching Friends. I don't believe you.
This is a dark world, Willa.
No, it's not. The thing about Friends that also is different is like this cross-gender thing. Like, I think the fact of Friends being about like young, romantic, nice-looking people of different genders like does actually set it apart. I think it sort of scratches the rom-com itch in addition to sort of the sitcom itch. And it is amazing, if you think about it, that Friends is this popular. It's like a really wild and crazy thing. But I actually don't think it's because it's bad. Like, things that are really bad don't actually last this long.
Well, Sachi, what about you? I mean, I'm thinking part of, we're saying it was the 90s. And I think what I meant by that is that there were less offerings, in terms of what you were consuming. And there is a sort of a lightness to the show that I think.
Yeah, that's probably very comforting. I don't think it's a mistake that a much younger generation that has grown up in an incredibly fraught time where everything hurts is connecting to a show that is kind of easy, and you can watch any episode in a vacuum and everything sort of returns to some sort of status quo. And I also don't think it's a mistake that stylistically it looks like how all these kids are dressing. Everyone's wearing high-waisted jeans and teeny tiny sweaters. Like, I don't think these things are accidents, and that's fine. I think everyone's entitled to watch garbage.
Sachi Cole, senior culture writer at BuzzFeed, and Willa Paskin, Slate's TV critic, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.